what I want, what I'm going to do is just is give you a look at some of the some images of the campus from the point of its design, and give you some history and context, kind of both in terms of the design philosophies, but also in terms of where we've come. And it's a really different place now than it was 50 years ago when it was being designed. The impetus was to get out of here, out of Navy Pier. It was promised over 100 years ago in the late 1800s that U of I was going to have a presence in Chicago. And it never happened. And what basically the university's hand was sort of forced. I don't think, find that's putting it perhaps too strongly, because I don't think there was any real hesitation so much as lack of resources. But with GIs returning from World War II and the GI Bill, it was pretty clear that they couldn't all fit in Urbana, and many of them simply couldn't move there. And they were in Chicago, so the two-year campus was open at Navy Pier in 1946, and it became readily obvious that there needed to be some sort of campus presence. I am occasionally disappointed because, especially on days like today, I think, well, you know, if we would have stayed at Navy Pier, one of the sites under consideration was Mix Field, we could have had a campus on the lake shore, you know? How awesome would that have been? There was Garfield Park as a possible place, Miller Meadow, which is kind of lost in the mist of time, which is sort of by First and Roosevelt Road. It had been an airfield, checkerboard field, and it was the site of, it was mainly used by the U.S. Postal Service for airmail delivery in the 1920s. And then South Loop, which was actually not all that much under consideration at first, until Mayor Daley kind of looked at it and looked at what was happening in the neighborhood. And without getting, you know, without turning this into a political discussion, he basically saw the encroachment and had made some commitments to public housing. And so he saw the university as a way to kind of get out of those commitments. Because if you look at, you know, and it's changed greatly now, but if you look at where, particularly to the southwest of campus, the Adams Homes, I'm blanking on the name of the other project there.
Taylor.
This was supposed to have been the next major development, and he wanted to, you know, and politics and race and, you know, good Lord, we could go on for the next 2 hours on that. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't for design purposes, because the designers, and NETCH was not really in the loop at that point, but the designers and developers were particularly focused on Miller Meadow, actually, until the mayor started pushing in this direction. I'll talk more about the design principle as we look at pictures. But one of the important things about the campus to keep in mind is that a very important consideration was how can you build the campus in such a way to isolate it from the sounds of the city, from the noise. So you had the expressway running here, and you had a relatively busy street in Halsted, and a couple of others in Taylor and Roosevelt. And so how do you create a kind of, you know, I don't want to say traditional, but traditional in the sense of kind of sonic environment campus where people can walk around, sit on benches, you know, have discussions about big ideas and whatnot without being overwhelmed by, you know, the semis jake breaking as they're coming up on the loop, you know, this kind of thing. And one of the approaches was to use granite, which was readily available from quarries in Indiana and downstate Illinois. Because a big part of the mandate was to create an instant campus. It was very much the mayor's goal to ramp up this operation as quickly as possible. So, and I don't know the exact figures, but something like in 65, when it first opened its doors, there were something like 7,000 students. And just 5 years later, there were 20,000. So the goal was really, you know, how do we manage this kind of massive growth? That's NETCH on campus, just after the first phase of construction. He designed the U.S. Air Force Academy, Regenstein Library, and Hyde Park, a number of buildings in Northwestern. After you've been in this building, if you go to Northwestern, you cannot mistake which buildings he designed at Northwestern. It's a very similar, and you'll see sort of the philosophy in some of these pictures. This is what it had been before it was all torn up. So this would be Halsted right here. You can see the remnants of Hull House here, the expressway down here, there's a semi. And this street that's sort of diagonal, that was Blue Island. Harrison would be right here. So, and you can sort of see the homes, right, encroaching, you know, from there. There's St. Ignatius. So it had already been cleared. You know, and the space was awaiting development.
Is that looking southwest?
Yes, yeah. This was the ribbon cutting. And the only reason I include this, other than to kind of, again, highlight Mayor Daley, is to ask, who's that? Anybody have a, either of you know? It was the student body president in 1965. No, I didn't either. It's Anthony Podesta, advisor to the Clintons, the Obamas now, major political strategist on the Democratic side. Until I found this photo, I had no idea, actually. Huh. I knew that he had connections to UIC. He majored in political science, but, you know, It was a bit shocking. This is a direct quote from Netsch. There's a wonderful oral history with him where he talks about his life and career. And so the principle here was the concept of the drop of water, the center, the forum, the exedra. People went to the school in the plaza, and they went to the library, and they went to church. We didn't have a church, but we had a student center. And it was a very simple philosophy, really. I mean, he on the one hand, he didn't want to reproduce the sort of, you know, Jeffersonian brick ivy kind of campus we have in Urbana, but he wanted to maintain, right, the kind of spirit that such a campus embodies, but in an urban setting. And so, how do you do this in a way that's, you know, both capturing the urban presence, but not in such a way that it overwhelms the sort of, you know, placid environs that you need for contemplation, for discussion, and so on. This was one of the drawings, the original drawings, and so this is Halsted. Harrison is over here. We're over here, parking lot there. This is phase one. This is University Hall, the tallest building on campus. And this is the central core, which I'll concentrate on the next couple of slides. This is the student center, expressways here. A different aerial view. There's University Hall over there. The campus core is here. Science and engineering labs, student center, libraries. You can sort of get, I think, a sense of how this core was supposed to almost, you know, buttress or buffer the center of the campus, which was intended to be this this area in the middle here. This building would have buffered from the Ryan or from Halsted. This would have buffered the campus to the west. And the north side here, you had residence halls wrapping around. You know, and then obviously on the south, the science and engineering labs would have. It was a very contained sort of unit in its first phase. And then this is a science and engineering lab as well, science and engineering south. So this is that science and engineering lab, and this is looking, we'd be looking from from Roosevelt to the north here. And so you'd have a very broad kind of sidewalk, and you'd walk up a ramp to get to the second floor of the building. And that's a key in understanding what he was trying to do, I think. He wanted to build all of these walkways, and at one point the campus was chock full of these. another example. This is Harrison, Halstead. Here's the loop. And so you'd have this walkway. University Hall would basically be right here. You'd have this walkway that would take you across, down, and to the L stop that was being built right there. You also had walls, and again here, what these walls are doing is buffering the campus from the noise to the north. And you also had a huge wall built here, a good chunk of which still remains. There was a ComEd substation right here that they couldn't move, and so the only, the only way he saw around it was to just build this giant wall around it. A lot of the controversy that stemmed from the decision to put the campus here had to do with the buildup of these walls, right? Which the neighborhood saw as a way to just stay out of, to kind of isolate the campus and try to ignore kind of what was going on in the surrounding area. This is the student center looking to the west. This is Halstead Street. There's Hull House, and there's another part of Hull House to the left of that, which still stands. Netsch was directly responsible for keeping those two remaining buildings. If it wouldn't have been for him, we would have lost pretty much all trace of Hull House, which as a quick aside, I have a strong interest in, because one of the things that I'm involved with is recreating history through virtual reality. And Hull House is one of those things that we've worked on recreating. And it's been really good to have those, because looking at existing maps and texts and things, there's much disagreement about where the buildings actually were. So at least we have two where we can precisely say, this is where they go. This is the drawing of what he envisioned. This would be the student center here. And then this is the campus core, the forum for him. So you have walkways up here. You have a kind of forum here, seating in the center. And then underneath, you have lecture rooms. Another example of it here. Science and Engineering Lab is here. Student Center is here. Library is here. And this is that walkway that connects you to University Hall and then on to the L. Everything was connected through walkways. And some of them, I don't think you see any of them in this picture, some of them were covered as well. And part of the thinking here, too, was that this would be a way to keep people out of the elements. Part of what happened in terms of these being torn down was maintenance. I mean, we have something like over $1 billion in deferred maintenance on this campus. So you can imagine, right, when you have to join big blocks of granite together, and you have to do these with rubber joints that have to be repeatedly lubricated and sealed, you start to kind of not do the maintenance because the budget isn't that good that year, and after a while, instead of protecting you from the elements, really it doesn't do much at all, and in fact it causes problems when the granite starts to crumble and bits fall off. That's kind of the short version. At night, this was a really dramatic scene. The lecture centers had transparent roofs. I wish, and they were sort of a kind of a tarnished copper green. And I wish I could find a color photo of this, but I haven't. I've never been able to. And if I can't find it in our archives, it doesn't exist. I don't think anyone else would probably have it, because this is taken from up above in University Hall, and it's just a spectacular sight at night to see this kind of glow of light arising from where the center of student activity was supposed to be. And then particularly in evenings, because for a long time, I mean, we're now far less, I mean, we're almost unrecognizable in terms of the change to the commuter sort of quality of the campus. But originally, there were very, very few students living on campus. That number's grown dramatically. So at night, the place really lit up, especially by comparison to today. Another example of, so there's the, this would have been a lecture center. That's where the light was emanating from. The central forum is right there, looking directly from above. And so you can imagine some of the challenges here sonically. Now, interestingly, from everything that I've ever been able to glean, Netsch did not think that much about acoustics, which is strange because when he was teaching at MIT, he actually strongly agitated for and got an acoustics course into the architecture curriculum. But here it seems, and I don't know that anybody directly asked him about it, but here it seems, in that rush to create the instant campus, acoustics was largely overlooked. Other concerns, and not just in terms of the outside of the campus, where as we'll see when we go out in a little bit, it's kind of crazy in some spots. Less so now than it was back when the walkways were out. But in the interior spaces were incredibly difficult acoustically too. And I think some of the rooms in this building might be open. We can on our way out, I can show you a couple of them. We've gone to great lengths. I mean, so this acoustical stuff, we've gone to great lengths to try to make some of these spaces ones in which you can teach, because there are some rooms where it's almost hopeless because the shapes are so odd. But that is partly not his fault, because we subdivided so much of the space in odd ways ourselves after the campus was designed that you end up with these really weird and then it's all granite and it just gets really difficult. So this is a bit of a close-up. You'll still see some of these, these are sort of fence posts with chain around them. There's still some of these around on campus. But if you can imagine sort of walking, above here, in fact, it doesn't, what happens is that, you try to kind of buffer the campus from the external sound, but then when you elevate everybody, you elevate them above the buffer. Right? And then when you go under, right, you get these weird sort of zones of amplification where things get difficult too. And then if you have a lot of problem with echo and feedback in these spaces too. Our lecture centers, which are still around, were some of the most difficult buildings to contend with acoustically. We have a terrific, just an amazing architect full-time on campus, just joined about 5 years ago, a fellow named Dave Tayerts, who's really taken on the notion of kind of creating working learning environments and dramatically revamping some of these spaces. If it wasn't for him, and here's a view under the walkways during construction. So even here, for instance, you can sort of see the lecture center itself is recessed under the walkway, and that's the student center over there on the left. It's very futuristic in a lot of ways. I mean, if the campus, so I'll talk about this a little bit in a few minutes, but if the campus, if it wouldn't have been a state school, that's number one, and if it would have had a lot of private money, a huge endowment, this could have been an incredibly futuristic campus, because of, the maintenance would have continued to have been done, but also because the campus would have continued on with the following phases of his plan, and it never went farther really than phase two. There were four phases, and we kind of quit for financial reasons. Here's the central forum, and that's still there, although almost all its seating's been removed, and we'll walk through there. That's looking through toward the south, through the science and engineering labs. Looking to the north along that same walkway. Another view of, the lighting, from what I can tell in photos, was pretty good, but it's still, it's still a little foreboding, So part of, I think one of the unintended consequences of the design here was you go from this kind of bright, outdoor space, you get a view of the city virtually unobstructed. And then you kind of walk down into this dungeon for your classes, which Yeah, it protects you from the elements, but it's also not necessarily, optimal. Another view from below. I mean, from below, you get, it reminds me of, kind of walking around Disneyland or Disney World, where you see kind of the monorails going by, but then the track and everything else is just like, do I really want this in my way? One of the original drawings. The main reason I include this, because I always get a kick out of this drawing, is if you look right here, there's a classic, there's a very sort of early 60s looking jacket, striped shirt, and the guy smoking a pipe, right? This is what our students were going to be like in Chicago. I don't think so. and it's not like stock, it's not like they had a computer that they were just pulling kind of stock images from. Somebody actually kind of drew this guy, and it's just, this is kind of what we think. In practice, this is greatly emphasized by the quality of the print, the sort of, dungeon-like image. And then you can see, where all of the joins are, how much work would have had to have been done to keep it up. Another slightly, different exposure, same scene, essentially. Kind of a forest of concrete pillars. It looks like a very blocky campus, in no small part because of the large granite blocks. But the goal, actually, what Netsch had in mind, this was just at the time that that DNA, the double helix, was coming to prominence, not just as science, but also as kind of a philosophy of life, in essence, the building block of life. And so his goal was really, and it stems from that notion of the forum. Was that he sort of saw the drop of water, but he saw it as a double helix emanating out. So if you look from above, right, he designed stairways to try to, but again, kind of form and function. So if you're walking up this ramp, you would go up here, then you'd take a little zigzag here, right, and then you'd go up here, and it was just, why would you force people to do these kind of weird, these weird jogs in that space? That's a ground level example of what it looked like. And this is where we are, and that's University Hall. So there was one of these between the two buildings here. And the interesting thing, of course, about it was from above it looks beautiful, right? But from below, so once that central core was completed, that's when buildings like this one, Science and Engineering South, were built. Art and Architecture was built. And it was a different philosophy at that point, or at least slightly different, because at that point, the idea was we're going to group particular faculties together. So social sciences are here. Art and Architecture is there. Theater and Performing Arts is over there. Science and Engineering. So we started to get a little bit different. And the circulation changes, therefore. On the campus. Originally, almost all the activity took place in the lecture centers, and then the offices were in University Hall in our 28-story tower. And with the growth of the campus, it was pretty clear that we couldn't house everything we needed to. We wouldn't have the lab space, we wouldn't have the teaching space, and so on. And so these other elements started to be built. This is a design sketch for this building. And it gives you an idea, I think, of how, again, the central core was supposed to be right there, and then these kind of areas around it. The idea was to have a kind of a spiral that you could walk through. Of course, as you've seen just from finding this room, that's not necessarily the way that we find our way around. I mean, we're very much, for good or worse, we're of a grid mindset. Interesting as this is, it really wreaks havoc with wayfinding for most people. Another sketch, so we're basically here. We're right in that spot.
Is that the whole behavioral sciences building?
This is the first floor.
Okay.
And it's, so there's large, and even these are sort of subdivided on here, although they weren't originally intended to be. The big lecture center is here, another big one here, and then there were supposed to be four large ones here that have been subdivided into smaller rooms. And then these are supposed to be classrooms on the periphery, but these have been subdivided as well. And then these have been turned into these kind of conference rooms. So you end up with some really weird spaces. That's almost unnecessary considering that you walked up to the building. That's the sort of twin of this building is Science and Engineering South. And that's it has a little bit of a different entryway than this does. This is sort of the plaza. And again, up above this, right, there was one of those forum spaces. But underneath, you know, as we'll see when we go by there, I mean, acoustically, it's a bit of a mess. Interior here, we can take a quick walk around that. Again, the principle of the forum radiating outward. So we never did a phase three or a phase four. Basically, what happened was that as the campus started looking at where its growth had been, and as it started to look at funding for maintenance for new construction, the walkways, about 1990-ish, the walkways started coming down. There was addition of green space, and we started to consider turning the campus sort of more toward a green campus than an urban campus. And there's been much sort of philosophical wrangling over what this means and how to achieve it and so on. There's still remnants that you'll see of what the campus had looked like, such as this one. This is by the, there's a residence hall here, and then this was a walkway that led over to art and architecture. And this is all that remains, and that's still there today. This had been, if you remember that double helix ramp, this had connected to that, and then connected over here to the Behavioral Sciences Building. Mm-hmm. And so now that's actually been enclosed. It's part of a coffee shop that's in here. This is the original sketch for the library, which shows that ramp coming over to here. And then there were these sort of, these are supposed to be like little meeting spaces, benches and whatnot. But again, the idea being that they'd be kind of covered and closed, not entirely enclosed, but you know, protecting people from the elements. That's what the design looked like when the campus opened. You can see that meeting space there, the ramp to the walkway. And that's what it looks like now. Similarly here, this is where you entered. Actually, no, this is the back of the building. There had been a walkway there, and so that's been closed off. And this is what remains of that central core. It's gone. Right. This is one of the four lecture centers, and that's the student center back here. But all of this stuff that had been overhead, including the forum, is gone. All that remains of the forum is this sort of little seating area here, and its counterpart over on this side. Everything else is gone. One of the interesting things is they carted the granite off to the South Lakeshore Drive, Lakeshore area, kind of probably between about 18th and 57th, and kind of dumped it in there to build up kind of a reef against the lakeshore there. So, you know, most of what had been part of this campus is now, you know, swimming with the fishes, to use the lingo. And then this is University Hall, which is now, you know, completely, you know, the effort's been to try as much as possible to surround it by green space, plantings, and so on, although it's not, you know, you'll see an example of how that's still not completed or successful. But one of the quick sort of myths to dispel, you might notice how the building sort of expands outward, right, as it goes up. And one of the myths, of course, is that, as on so many campuses, this seems to be one of those common urban myths about campuses. There's always a building that expands as it goes up, the thought being that if the building was ever bombed, that whatever valuable things had to be stored, be it computers or archives or whatever, would go in the basement, and the building wouldn't cave in, it would fall outward, everything would be safe in the basement. And that has absolutely no basis in reality. The metaphor here, right, was to show that the campus espoused the phrase "the city of big shoulders," and so this building was to have big shoulders. And this sort of causes interesting issues. I mean, when I was dean, my office was in there, and a number of our departments have their home in there, and there's really interesting issues in terms of for those departments that are on the upper floors that have the cantilever spaces, particularly the first couple, issues with heating and ventilation were particularly interesting because they had nothing, you know, on those ends, they had nothing underneath them. And so they were rather more exposed than the other floors. The interesting thing here is that student movement is by and large the same as it used to be. I mean, students walk along the same paths that they did when the walkways were here, of course. But now that the walkways are gone, we really haven't changed the flow and circulation on campus. It still kind of proceeds in much the same fashion. The sounds of the city still intrude here, but I think in more interesting ways. I mean, it's a little bit foolish to think that you can ignore the fact that you're in the city, and so you basically compensate, like you do any place in the city if it's noisy. Maybe you go inside, maybe you talk a little more loudly, maybe you find a place that's a little bit sheltered, what have you. But where the sound of the campus, I think, has really changed, and you can see this more in if it were a weekday, is in the degree to which students are using mobile devices. So, you know, instead of having kind of groups of students walking together talking, you have individual students walking, talking into a cell phone or listening to music on headphones. And so the sound of the campus really changes. When I first moved here in 97, if you went through that central core area around lunchtime, you'd hear a lot of noise, a lot of students talking, eating lunch, whatever. And now what you see is pretty much, you see some bit of that. It hasn't completely gone away by any stretch of the imagination. But you more see students sitting by themselves, talking on the phone or texting, or with earbuds in, listening to music. And that changes dramatically, you know, what a campus traditionally sounds like. You probably see it even more, I think, you know, in my experience, in Urbana, where there's a huge quad and the student population is about double what it is here. You know, this place that had been sort of boisterous is really considerably quieter. But it's also, you know, this sort of weirdly disconnected sonic environment. And to me, you know, it's interesting here because we have a much different acoustic environment than you have on a campus like Urbana's, where the space is wide open. There's really no sounds of much of anything to intrude. You know, here part of the response almost seems to be, you know, I'm going to find ways to kind of create my own insular sonic space, and with some degree of success. You know, I can say a few things about some of these issues, but the consequences of using mobile devices, I think, fall into these categories. Not the least of these is mobility. I mean, one of the things that's changed now, but a few years ago, before we were so overwhelmed with, you know, electromagnetic radiation, there were spots on campus where you couldn't get a good cell signal, and student traffic in those areas dwindled. Right, I mean, they knew to walk around them basically, so that their call wouldn't drop. You know, talking on the phone changes in those circumstances how you make your way around campus. Sociability and etiquette, it's been interesting to watch how students deal with one another. You know, if two students who are friends are both on the phone with somebody else, you know, how they sort of acknowledge, you know, say hi to each other without breaking the call, you know, and kind of just sort of standing, waiting, talking, and then kind of moving off together when both calls are done. Intimacy and privacy, I mean, it kind of goes without saying, I suppose, security and safety. Surveillance for me is an interesting one on campus, in part because you know, when you're outside, if you look up, you can, the whole campus is under video surveillance. The whole city is now too, so this is almost a moot point. But we have a lot of students who are involved with location-based services where they're checking in on Foursquare and other sorts of things, saying, here I am, here's what I'm doing, kind of stuff, which is an interesting thing on a campus where some spaces are meant to be public and some are meant to be more private, and you can sort of follow these people around as they move. You know, each of these issues has direct connections to sound in one way or another, and that's I'd like to see more people, particularly in my field in communication, sort of taking on some of the challenges involved in thinking about what sound means. We're a very, like so many other fields, we're a very ocular-centric field, and I'm as guilty as anyone. I like eye candy. I work in a visualization lab, for Pete's sake. But you know, you can't do that at the expense of thinking about what sound means in these environments, and you know, in terms of the visual environment as well. If you're looking for more information, actually, the first three people here, Linda Naru is in our library at USC, is a just a fount of information about NETCH. Bob Brugman teaches in our School of Art and Architecture and has written terrific work, particularly on suburban sprawl, both its good and bad aspects. Eileen Tanner wrote a little, almost like a postcard-sized book about the NETCH campus. It has some wonderful pictures and things that's available in our bookstore. And then, yeah, actually, you have my email, so that's kind of a moot point. Any thoughts or questions? We can head on out.
All the surveillance that was in the list of your previous slide, there would be visual surveillance.
Right.
It always is.
It always
just
is.
Cameras, so yeah. Far. So there's no listening stations set up.
No, I mean, that's always been a bizarre, you know, it's, and we had some dealings with Chicago's Emergency Operations Center a few years back. We're looking at some of our large displays. And this was actually back when Ron Huberman was, I can't remember what his title was. He was basically working for CPD. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, it would seem to me that you could much more easily automate a means of sonic surveillance and look for fingerprints, you know, essentially, of particular sounds that you're interested in, gunshots, what have you, explosions. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to be able to do that through video, at least not with the technology we have. And it just, you know, it's one of those things where it's just for people who are looking for re-election, for people who are looking for big career moves, it's not sexy. Right? Putting a giant display on a wall and putting cameras everywhere, that's cool. Putting microphones someplace and then writing an algorithm that figures out, you know, what a sound is and if it's out of the norm, whatever. Effectiveness doesn't really seem to play into that equation all that much. Mm-hmm.